Good morning, Charlie.
Morning, Barry. We decided that age was going to go before beauty, so Barry is starting this morning.
I'll just ignore that. You know, your Blue Dog Democrats got beat, left town, turned the Congress over to basically two groups of people. Tea Party right-wing nuts and Pelosi left-wing nuts. It's like the story of this relatively old couple. He loved to introduce his wife as the mother of six. In public, he would say things about being the mother of six, and she tried to get him to shut up, and he wouldn't shut up. So one night at the party, he said, "Come on, mother of six, we got to go home." And she said, "Yes, father of four, I'll be with you in a moment." Somehow that describes the U.S. Congress today. The news of the day is that the United States Congress is doing to America's farmers what it has been doing to the American economy since 2007. Agriculture has been the bright spot because agriculture had certainty. Agriculture had a farm bill that they could work with. No longer true. The Congress is doing to the farmer just what it's done to the small businessman, to the rest of the economy, creating all this uncertainty in the midst of a Great Depression-like drought. Last Gallup poll, Congress's rating was 9%. Frankly, and I think Charlie agrees with this, if I was a congressman, I would be too embarrassed to go home. And boy, are they going to get an earful, and they deserve every damn bit of it. Once again, however, agriculture does stand out. I'm proud of the ag leaders. They're good for agriculture, and they make the overall leadership of Boehner and Pelosi and Reid and McConnell look like a bunch of incompetent dogs. The relationship between Stabenow and Roberts is classic, and they produce a very workable farm bill. They know how democracy is supposed to work. The same has occurred over in the House. Congressman Lucas and Congressman Peterson worked well together, delivered a farm bill with a vote of 35 to 11. Those bills are not that far apart. Both committees went home and listened to farmers, and farmers kept telling them all across this country, "We know we have a tight budget. We got to protect something, and what we have to protect is crop insurance." Both committees did that. Now, my friends over in the House, and I don't know if they learned this from you or not, just simply can't forget that old target price program that never worked. I have been able to teach my KU friends, and that's damn difficult, that the target price is backwards. We have widespread drought like we have now, and our farmers are in deep trouble, and the price will move above the target, and they won't get paid. Then we have a bumper crop. They've got something to sell. They'll make some money. Price will fall below target, and we'll get the payment. So hopefully in Congress, the Senate will prevail and put that 1930s target price plan to bed. But that is the major difference, I would argue. And even that can be handled. Now, the real problem for farmers is no different from the problem of small businessmen, from the problems of those you represent in the oil patch, for example. And that problem, which faces us all, is the fiscal cliff. You want to be a small businessman or a farmer and borrow money with a B-rated bond by your government? If we go over this cliff, that is likely to happen. There's $4.5 billion of cash just laying in the economy, uninvested. It is not economic uncertainty that's the problem in this country. It is political uncertainty. If we got that $4.5 billion invested, we'd grow 5%. But no, we can't make a decision. We don't have the guts to tackle it. Come December 31, we've got to decide on the Bush tax cuts. And $1.5 billion will be sequestered. Half of that to defense, and a small amount to agriculture. But, as General Eisenhower would say, D-Day has arrived. This is no longer a political matter to be just kicked down the road. We have got to solve this fiscal crisis. Can we go bankrupt? You're damn right we can go bankrupt. And then a farm bill will look minor. And what is so sad about this, and what embarrasses me so about the U.S. Congress and that group of incompetent people, that's the best way to describe the U.S. Congress. Simpson and Bowles handed them the answer and did all the work for them. They just needed the guts to bite the bullet. Clearly the biggest mistake that Barack Obama has made in 3.5 years is to ignore Simpson Bowles. I think it's clear he gets that now, and I would challenge him. It's not too late. Do something that, by God, a politician has forgotten how to do, and that is, I was wrong. And put that on the table. We all know there's only one way to get out of this mess, and that is to cut spending and increase taxes. It's time to do it. It's time to bite the bullet. Now, some of you are saying, well, boy, he's pretty negative. I haven't heard him be that negative in a long time. And that bothers me. I was born an optimist, and I'll die an optimist. But I sure as hell better not die tomorrow. It's like this old couple getting ready to go to bed. And she stood nude before the mirror, and she looked herself over, and she said, oh, God, I'm ugly. And I'm fat. And things are drooping, and on and on and on. And then she said to him, you've got to tell me something positive. I need something positive before I go to bed. And I feel this way today. I need something positive. And her husband looked at her and said, dear, you have damn near perfect eyesight. Unfortunately, the Congress of the United States needs to go to see an ophthalmologist. It's frankly time We tell them to put up or shut up. We want change, and we want it now. Now, I will end in an optimistic note. I've been teaching ag policy for 41 years at Kansas State University, and I have quite a few farmer students in the audience, and I don't want to insult you, but I just had the best class I ever had. They're serious-minded, they're hard-working, they know the situation they're in. I apologize to them for the mess my generation is leaving them, but they're willing to take it on. So the future is optimistic. Charlie?
You know, one thing about Barry, you know where he stands. You know, I've known him for a long time. And in my years in the United States Congress, when farm bills, farm policy, agricultural questions, I always called Barry to find out what he thought. And then I would call an expert to know what I should know. You know, you hear, you know, he's been a little tough on Congress, and we deserve it. There's no question about that. But, you know, one thing you can't accuse Barry of being is two-faced. Tells it like it is. Now, if he had another face, do you think he'd be using the one he's using this morning?
A lot younger.
Yeah, a lot younger. You know, where to kind of fill in the, you know, to have a debate, you've got to disagree. And we'll find a few places in there that we can disagree. But Barry's pretty well laid it out, the challenges for the Congress, for the people. It's there. It's real. It cannot be ignored. And we've got a lot of challenges now on the agricultural side is how we address that, because with only 150,000 of us producing 75% of everything it's produced, that's a pretty small minority. In my real life now, I'm Professor Stenholm. I'm getting a chance to enjoy what Barry has enjoyed over the last umpteen years. But I'm teaching a class on ag policy and political science at Tarleton State University on Monday nights. 3-hour course, catch an early morning plane to Washington on Tuesday morning, and go up and teach Washington what I learned at Tarleton on Monday night. They're not paying attention.
Tell them what textbook you use. Well,
it's got Flinchbaugh's name on it, but there's but there's two other professors that I kind of use, and I mark out Flinchbaugh. But no, it is the text, the Bible of ag policy and history, and you know you have to look a little bit at where you've been in order to know where you're going. And that's been my philosophy all the years. And where have we been now on agriculture policy brings us to where most of us in agriculture spend a lot too much of our time bragging about how good we are to ourselves. And the American people aren't getting it. That's very evident because whether you like it or not, Congress is a mirror of the American people. I don't know how many times that I've looked in the mirror getting up to go to work and look at some of my colleagues and wonder how in the thunder did they get elected. And then I look in the mirror and, you know, I realize they wonder the same thing about me. How could I have been elected to Congress? But we are. Everyone that gets to the House of Representatives is elected by a majority of the people within their district to do what you would have them to do. The problem is not too many of us are participating in the political process, particularly in the young people, particularly in the young. You don't participate, and then it's very good reason. You've got other things on your mind to be thinking about and doing, and that time will come. But as Barry said, our generation, we kind of live in a mill of a hess right now. $16 trillion in debt. I remember going through the $1 trillion debt. I remember going into President Reagan's office, sitting down one-on-one with he and his chief of staff, and him asking me to help him and the Congress pass a debt ceiling increase through $1 trillion, which we did back in those days. It took bipartisan support. President Reagan was a Republican. The Congress was Democrat. When he reached out his hand to we conservative Democrats, if I had not taken it, I wouldn't have got reelected, and I wouldn't have voted for myself. You know, my political philosophy is you get elected. I'm a Democrat. Barry's a Republican. But the day after the election, we can set aside our partisan and say, how can we work together to solve the problems of our country? That's what's missing today. Compromise is not a four-letter word. It has never been. If compromise would have been a four-letter word, and if the Tea Party would have reigned, and I don't say this disrespectfully, folks, I have met a lot of Tea Party folks, the new ones in Congress. Most of them pretty darn good, solid folks. And they would say the same about Blue Dogs. Most of them are pretty good, solid folks. But we have find ways that we can disagree and fuss about it. But if our forefathers that wrote the Constitution would not have been willing to compromise, we wouldn't be here today. You wouldn't be doing what you're doing because strong-willed men at that time weren't able to agree, but they realized they had to compromise in order to get that which we needed. Unbelievable that Congress went home without passing a farm bill. It is awfully hard for me as a House member to say anything good about the Senate. It's just tough. I remember there's a story that was told that Speaker Sam Rayburn overheard a freshman congressman one day speaking of Republicans in a language unfit for women and children's ears. And Speaker Rayburn went over to this freshman congressman and said, Lyndon Johnson, would you come into my office for a moment? And he explained to this freshman congressman that Republicans are not the enemy. They're the opposition. It's the Senate is the enemy of the House. Now, the Senate passed what I consider a fairly decent farm bill. Would it have been one that I would have worked and passed exactly like? No, none of them are. But then the House got one out of committee, but it was not brought to the floor of the House for a vote. Shame on the leaders of the House of Representatives for not letting the people's representatives speak their will. Even though those of us who follow this ag policy very closely know there's a very good reason why Speaker Boehner did not. It couldn't pass. It was going to tear up the Republican Party because they were going to insist on more cuts on the SNAPs program than was going to be able to get a majority vote. And it was going to take a bipartisan vote. It was going to take Democrats, just like the drought bill. 46 Democrats voted for it. 46 Republicans voted against the drought bill that passed. Our political atmosphere is broken. Now, we're going to have election November the 6th, and everything is going to happen after November the 6th. I don't think so. I don't think this election is going to change anything, no matter who's elected, because we're a divided country, 50-50, on almost any issue that you want. Now, that sounds pessimistic. I'm not a pessimist. I'm a realist. It's going to take some leadership, and I think Barry's right. I think any member of the House Ag Committee or the Congress from a rural district is catching, you know, what for. I remember a budget vote in 92 in which I eventually voted for a compromise in order to get something out of the Congress, and it included a BTU tax. And I remember getting literally met by the little ladies in tennis shoes with their placards protesting me and saying that I was history. This is my third term. I was history. Well, I wasn't. But I respected their right to protest and to have their opinions voiced to me. Opinion. I teach a class. This will be my third semester starting now, August the 27th. And I tell the first question my students ask me, do you give pop tests? And I said, no. I said, we're going to like this class. I said, no, I don't give pop tests. And said, I'm, you know, not going to give any real tough tests because we're going to talk mostly about opinion. I'm going to share my opinion of what happened at different times during my 26 years in the Congress and now eight afterwards, and we're going to talk about current events. I'm going to give you my opinion, and I'm going to ask for yours. How could I grade you on your opinion? Because you might be right. You know, we've got the fiscal cliff. We've got the world population going to increase by 3 billion over the next 50 years and a lot of concern about how they're going to be fed. Well, most of the American people really don't care whether that world is going to be fed or not. Even those of us who go to church regularly, that's not really on our top agenda. But those of us who do care, we realize the only way that world can be fed is through biotechnology. Genetically modifying that which we do. Learning to grow plants that will use less water and produce more food. That's important to me. But as I speak to other audiences around that are not prejudiced towards agriculture, they really could care less about that. In fact, they've got concerns. I do a lot of work now for the oil and gas industry. Over the last 8 years, I have had clients of Big Oil, Little Oil, and Texas Oil. And people say, there's a difference. And I said, you better believe there's a difference. For several years, I was speaking on behalf of drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. And I've made the point that we have never had a major spill in the Gulf of Mexico, even Katrina. We've never had a major spill, but we could have one tomorrow. And then BP occurred, and it was a doozy. And we found out in the industry we weren't nearly as prepared as we were telling people that we were prepared. And now we have discovered a large supply of natural gas through hydraulic fracturing. And I'm making a lot of speeches on behalf of that, saying we have never, in 60 years, we have never had a problem with our subsurface water or surface water as a result of hydraulic fracturing. But we could have one tomorrow. Now, the bottom line is we need the energy. You cannot produce food, feed, fuel, and fiber today without oil and gas. You cannot produce oil and gas today without food, feed, fuel, and fiber. We're both minority interest in the political sense, big time. There's less oil and gas producers than there are farmers and ranchers. But all 310 million Americans can't do without both of us. And I spend a lot of time trying to keep the industries from shooting each other. There's no reason for farmers to be mad at oil companies or oil companies to be mad at farmers. We'll talk a little about RF in just a minute when we get RFS standards, when we get the questions in just a little bit. But I'll kind of sum up by where we are and answer the question of why would anybody with an interest in agriculture talk about energy? Well, most farmers know you can't run the tractor without diesel fuel. And as I've spoken on behalf of the oil and gas industry, I make this point very clearly. We need all of the supplemental energy that we can produce. And I don't use the word alternative. That's another one of the errors, I think, that this administration has made. The belief that government can superimpose its will and develop energy that is not market sustainable and have it sustainable. I just don't believe that the world has ever seen that happen for very long. But I point this out. When I say all, it's kind of like when Barry says we need to cut spending and raise taxes. I say a little bit different. You got to cut spending, that's for sure, and nothing can be exempt. And there is more waste, fraud, and abuse in the defense spending than there is in the SNAPS program and can prove it. But that's immaterial to the debate. Everything has to be on the table. With energy, we support all, we meaning the oil and gas industry, all supplemental energy, nuclear, wind, solar, hydro, biofuels, coal, and oil and gas. And I would challenge any of you to find one of the so-called environmental supporters of any of the supplementals that are for all. If it's wind, the turbines are killing birds. If it's solar, we're interrupting the sex life of lizards in the desert. If it's hydro, we're interrupting the fish flow. If it's bio, we're interrupting our food supply. If it's coal, we're doing something to global warming. If it's oil, we're doing something to global warming. If it's natural gas, we're doing less, but we're still doing something. That's the political discussion that we've got to come to. How do you, in fact, resolve those kind of differences and do what the future, our children and grandchildren and grandchildren and great-grandchildren are going to need? That's the challenge for agriculture today. We're the best-fed nation in the world today. Will we be there in 30 years? Legitimate question.
Yeah. Anybody in the audience got a question now? I'll start with Irvin. Raise your hand, and we'll get the mic to you.
Hi, I'm Irvin Lehner, and my question is the potential likelihood of further kicking of the can, both on the farm bill and on the fiscal cliff issue. What is the possibility that Congress will merely pass one-year extensions of the current farm bill and the Bush tax cuts, for that matter?
Well, Congress has been very good at two things. I'd give them A-plus on two things. One is kicking the can down the road. And two is protecting their own butt through reapportionment. That's bipartisan. So you would say it's very easy to predict that they're going to kick the farm bill down the road and they're going to kick the fiscal cliff down the road. But the problem is they cannot do that and get away with it this time, in my opinion. I know for a fact there's at least one freshman congressman that does not know that he can just vote no and we not have a farm bill and that's the end of farm programs. That's the level of intelligence in the U.S. House of Representatives. He doesn't know there's permanent legislation, and if we do nothing, we go back to the 1938 Act.
47 Act.
No, wait a minute. The basic act is 38. 47, we made some permanent amendments. But the basic act is still there.
Okay.
That's a minor point, but it's
I wasn't
a rather
born
important.
Yet.
You know, Charlie, this is the first time I've seen you protect your elders so well. So, when they don't know what they're doing, who knows what they'll do? There is a group called Fix the Debt that has just formed. This makes me very optimistic. It's chaired by former Governor Rendell of my home state of Pennsylvania, and that's the meanest junkyard dog in political history. You cross him and you'll remember it. And then Judd Gregg from New Hampshire, who's a very reasonable Republican. Few of which of those are left today. And they have Simpson Bowles behind them. They've got a whole group of statesmen behind them. They have a plan. Simpson believes this plan will pass by July 4. And what's so sad about all this is, you know, the president just needs a good kick in the butt for not endorsing Simpson-Bowles. It's very simple. And why Republicans won't endorse it is beyond me. They won the battle. They're getting 70% cuts. But no, God forbid, some billionaire would have to pay more taxes. As Simpson says, you want to solve this problem? Disband, outlaw the AARP, and deport Grover Norquist. And you can solve it. The days are over when Grandma could continue to rip off her grandkids like she's been doing for years. And I'm 70 years old, so I'm helping doing the ripoff. But it can be solved. And people know how serious it is. And miraculously, when we the people finally stand up and say, is enough enough? Enough is enough. Those congressmen increase their intelligence level. So it can be done in 2013, but it will be pushed down the road until the magic date, according to Simpson, is July 4th. And remember, in 06, we got a farm bill in April when we were supposed to get one in September of 05. So kick can down the road in the short run, but I think we now understand that it's serious enough. Those days are coming to a close. You agree?
Yep. I do, and just a couple of little factoids here. Congress has 13 working days between now and November the 6th. 13, from today, 13 days. So what are they going to do on the farm bill when they come back? It's going to be fascinating to sit back and watch, because they're going to be an attempt to do something, but can you get a bill through the House, conferenced, and passed by September the 30th. It's not necessary, as Barry says, that you can punt some of this. You can do some things, punt some of it into next year and complete the work next year, and I think that's what they will do. On the fiscal cliff, Congress has agreed that they're going to have a continuing resolution, which means spending will continue through next March at current levels. And they've agreed to that, so we're not going to have a shut-down-the-government moment again, as folks are going to fuss about whether you can get another billion or two cuts in spending. That's good. The idea that a lame duck session is going to solve this problem, I think, is a little bit far-fetched. Anything is possible, but not probable. And therefore, there will be, though, a serious effort to tell the markets that we are going to get serious and complete the work by the 4th of July or 1st of July next year. And that's going to be, and that is something that should be supported, because if you're going to do tax reform, you can't do that in 2 or 3 days. It's going to take some time. It's going to take some hearings. It's going to take some honest debate, and it's going to be very controversial. Spending cuts, no exceptions. And that means we Democrats have got to get over protecting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid to the detriment of fiscal sense. It's got to quit being a political issue, and it's got to be a realistic issue. When I say realistic, in the eyes of the marketplace. How long can we keep, as Americans, keep borrowing $16 trillion and adding a trillion and having interest rates below 2%. How long?
Not much longer.
That's my economist.
Not much longer. And I think people are seeing that. That's the reason for fix the debt.
Yep.
And these are serious people. And they have money. They have business community money. I think the business community has finally woken up that, by God, we could become another Greece. I think we've kidded ourselves for several years that that's not possible. And I think the agriculture committee, agriculture community rather, is waking up right now with this drought. They've had some several good years, and all of a sudden here's the drought. And we're having a hell of a time getting the entire body politic to see the importance of a drought, especially when you read all the misinformation in the newspaper that farmers are doing fine. Well, some are, but some aren't. And the drought is having an effect.
Got a question? Raise your hand. Otherwise, we'll filibuster. Or at least he will. I'm from the House. He's the senator.
I have a question. This is a tough one. Sylvia Lovely, Sunnyside Up Radio in Kentucky. You alluded to the fact that the American people just don't get it, that there's a lot of bragging among the choir, but that the American people really aren't connecting with this. One of the reasons, and you also alluded to this, is the bombardment of information that people have. They are frankly confused. That's what our demographic tells us. They don't know what to believe, and so they tune it out. The tough question is, how do you reach the American people? Because that's really where it's going to have to come from. It's got to come from the grassroots.
A lot of effort going into that now, and nobody has the answer. But I like one of the suggestions that I have liked coming, I've seen lately, and something that I've tried to do on both perhaps of agriculture and oil and gas, and that is to acknowledge the fact that we may have a problem with our food safety. We may have a problem with antibiotic use in livestock. I don't know if we do or we don't, but we may, and we are going to do everything we can to answer that question. Instead of saying we don't have a problem and turning it off and then watching it come on YouTube. Same way with hydraulic fracturing. Same way with deep water drilling. We may have a problem, but if we do, we can fix it because it's important to us that we fix it. Just a little twist of the way that we answer, instead of always being on the defensive, acknowledging that there may be a problem, unless you are so smart in your own mind that you know absolutely there is no problem. Global warming, for example. I don't know that we don't have a problem with fossil fuels doing something. And so it makes sense to me to reduce the amount of emissions if we can and do it in a way we don't shoot American workers in both feet in doing it, because shooting ourselves in both feet and letting the rest of the world, i.e. China and India, put out more carbon than we put out, not going to solve the world's problems unless you do it that way. But acknowledging that and then looking for ways to educate. I think our universities, and I know we're doing that, so that's why it's, you know, we're under tremendous fire now with agricultural research under fire because money is being cut. We don't have the money to do what our researchers say that we should be doing. The public support is drying up because that's budget cuts, and that's the easiest thing out there to cut. Okay. Then you start having the private sector funding the research, and immediately it is suspect. Because if you have an industry funding the research that tells you there is nothing wrong with what we're doing, guess what? I don't have to be the brightest bulb in the deck to say that's going to be easy to counteract. So how do we do that? Research and extension is how we got to where we are today. But it's not as good today as it was 50 years ago. We're now in a 24/7 media cycle in which any news, i.e., the only time I use this word one time, pink slime, lean, finely textured beef. How we ever let that destroy 700 jobs, a company that was doing what everybody says we need to do, and that's have leaner meat, less fat, and safer E. coli salmonella-free meat. And yet we let it get away from us. And I say we. I take my own share of the responsibility because I'm one of those lobbyists. So research, education, and constantly challenging ourselves, are we doing as good a job as we could be or should be?
been at this business about 45 years. And I can count on one hand the number of times I've been deliberately screwed by the agriculture media. I can count, don't have near enough of hands to count the times I've been screwed by the big city media. We need to bring some ethics back to journalism. And we've evolved, those of you that are right wing, you watch Fox and believe everything they tell you, including the biggest lie of all, fair and balanced. Those of you that are left wing watch MSNBC and believe everything you're told. And the big city media is no longer an educational tool. It's propaganda and entertainment. The days of Walter Cronkite are long gone. I had a chat with Ted Turner not too long ago. I get a big kick out of Ted. There's a fine line between a genius and an idiot. And he rocks back and forth. And what's so cute is that he knows that. But he seriously now questioned what kind of a monster has he created with 24/7 cable news. Education is obviously the answer. That's what a professor would always say. But it's not just the educational community. It's the farm community. It's you. And it is certainly the overall media that's very interested in agriculture. And they rarely get it right. Rarely get it right. And people believe it. For example, the food safety question. If I've ever watched an issue in my life that has been so screwed up, it's that one. Now, I had a health issue a year ago, so I'm a lot more cognizant of it. But when we come to food safety, we are attacking the exact wrong problem. We are spending billions telling people that organic is better for their health, inorganic, and it's a damn lie. We are spending billions telling people that GMOs will kill them. Well, we ship that GMO corn to Africa. It doesn't worry me whether they'll kill them, because if we don't ship it, they're going to die. Shipping it gives us a chance to save them. Yet we ignore the big three: salt, sugar, and saturated fat. What's killing America? What's making America fat? Sugar and saturated fat. I read labels. Hell, they put salt on toilet paper now. And I teach my students that you cannot solve a problem if you don't get it accurately defined. And that's why we make no progress on food safety. We don't know what the problem is. We won't listen to the scientists. And until we get over that, we're not going to make much progress on food safety. We don't need new laws. We need to listen to the scientists. And we need to buy healthy food. And all of a sudden, there will be healthy food in the grocery store. And it won't be in the organic section.
I think he just said balanced diet is just as good today as it was 50 years ago. Everything in moderation probably be a pretty good rule. But the 24/7 news cycle is a challenge, but it's there. So let's quit complaining about it, and let's figure out how we can use it to do what Barry just said. How can we in agriculture do that? Now, I want to disagree totally with one of the things, Barry, you said. When you blame the agricultural press, I don't blame y'all for anything. I'm looking at too many of you there, and I'm not sure I can get out this door. But y'all take on Barry.
You're trying to get me in trouble.
I did.
Because I didn't say what you just said. I said.
I don't care. I said. I heard I said what I heard you say, and that's what I'm sticking to.
You
that's politics.
That's right. Cindy said I'm supposed to talk into your right ear, not your left ear. Right? Yeah. But I want him on my left. You see.
Chris Clayton with DT, and I would like you guys to talk a little more about what you understand the financial cliff is. My understanding is if the tax cuts are all expired and the sequestration goes into effect, we create a recession over the first 6 or 8, 9 months of 2013. However, our budget deficit also ends up being cut in half because of all of those changes. What are the ramifications of just essentially doing nothing and letting all of that occur?
I'll take the first crack at that since I'm involved with the Fix the Debt movement and the Committee of Responsible Federal Budget and been in a lot of meetings in which we are putting together recommendations for the Congress to consider. The concern about going over the cliff is in this world that we're in now in which Europe has got all kinds of problems. We've got tremendous unrest in the Mideast and, you know, the Syria and all is how, if you went over the cliff, how far would you go before you stopped? Nobody knows the answer to that. There are those very sincerely in the Congress that are already saying, let's do it because kicking the can down the road is not going to do it. Let's take our medicine now. I'm not in that school. But I could get there. I am not the pessimist enough to say that the next Congress is not going to come up with something. It won't be Simpson-Bowles. They've got to change the name, but it needs to be something exactly like that. And it needs to cut spending, real spending, 70% and 30% increased revenue. Through tax reform is the best way to do it. But if it can't, increased revenue. And that's the problem. You know, when my friend on the Rights Party, all 10 running for president, when asked the question, if you were presented with a budget that cut $10 in spending for $1 in revenue, would you support it? And they said, no. Oh, that's where I was proud to be a blue dog, even though I'm extinct. Because those that believe in compromise on taxes, let me just make a little observation. I am so sick and tired of hearing about the Bush tax cuts. Can someone show me one thing that the Bush tax cuts did good for America when they were implemented in 2003? Remember, the cliff that we went over on the economy was after those cuts took effect. The unemployment, all of the things that happened. So, you know, we need to look at our tax code in a different eye, not just cutting. And we really, as a world, had better get concerned about income distribution. And I'm not saying that as a socialist. I'm saying that as a capitalist. We'd better take a look at the world and those countries in which you have the income centered in a very small percentage of people, and over half of the people hurting, particularly if they get hungry. And that's why the RFS standard question in the corn ethanol, it's not for the United States that I'm worried. It's for the rest of the world. Hungry people do not stay peaceful people. We're not going to be underfed in America anytime soon. Every time I hear my fellow farmers and farm organizations talk about if we don't change, we're going to grow hungry. We're not going to grow hungry in America. Come on. Not going to happen. But the rest of the world that depends on us will. And a hungry world is not a peaceful world. Organic. Barry said it. 4% of our consumption today is organic. And I remember talk about changing your mind. I was opposed to organic farming when I first got elected. to Congress. I thought that's the craziest thing I ever heard. But when I look at the money some of my organic farmers are making, I'm wondering why I'm not in that business. And I'm for them. I hope it goes from 4% to 8% to 16%, even 20% will be organic. Who can argue against it? But that means the other 80% still got to be produced.
I certainly can argue against 20%.
Take it.
And I don't have anything against organics as an entity or whatever you want to call it. And I've told farmer friends, you know, B.T. Bonnerman was right. There's a sucker born every minute. So if you can sell that stuff for twice what it's worth, do it. But you get to 20%, and we will never solve starvation in this world. That is a waste of resources. Now, I know they like to tell you they can feed the world. Well, I haven't seen their products yet that'll feed the world. So let it grow to 8, but not 20.
Now
we'll have a hungry world.
At this time, you weren't listening to me. And I'm supposed to talk in your right ear, too, and I can't do it from over here.
Okay. Well, explain yourself then.
Basically, I said, if there is a market there and it's a profitable market there that will buy 20%, I'm for them. That still leaves 80%. The question is profitable market. Now, to those that believe that we can produce our food supply in America totally without the use of bio and fertilizers and insecticides and fungicides and rodenticides, I got a little problem with them showing us how you can do that. So my point was the difficulty of getting from 4 to 8 is going to be substantial for the reason you mentioned, and that's cost. And why I brought up the income distribution is you've got to have the money to be able to afford to pay the extra buck or two a dozen for eggs or for milk or the other food. If you've got the money, why should anybody tell you what you can do and can't do, particularly if you're in the business of raising it for a profit and consuming it? That's what I thought I said.
I have a question. I'm Len Henderson with AgriMarketing Magazine. Could you give us your insights on the upcoming presidential election and who you forecast is going to be our next president?
You are the politician.
Okay, I'll give you my best shot at that question today, subject to revision in a couple of weeks.
Tomorrow,
yeah. First off, I think the House will stay Republican, and they're going to lose some seats, but it'll still stay Republican. The Senate is a toss-up, and I have a hard time saying it can go either way today. The fascinating Senate race is in Maine, in which the former governor, a Democrat running as an independent, has said he's not going to declare what he is until after he's elected. That's fascinating. And for some of the things he wants to see changed in the Senate, I'm kind of pulling for him. Because I'd love to see, no matter which party he affiliates with, that's immaterial. If he gets them to concede to him that this is what we will do if you join us, you'll see an improvement in the Senate. On the presidential race, today it's leaning towards Obama being reelected today. The only reason that I say that and the only reason that Obama is winning today is Romney is running such a poor campaign. It is pathetic. In fact, both of them. You know, I would like to hear both of them a little more specific on how they're going to solve our fiscal instead of punting. I agree totally with what Barry said in his opening remarks that if people ask me, all right, what were the mistakes Obama has made? And I said, I'll just give you one big one, not endorsing Simpson Bowles, because we would have had the fiscal cliff thing all worked out by now if he had a, but he didn't. And it takes presidential leadership and then it takes followership to get it, but that's my prediction today.
Well, I think Charlie's right on the House, unfortunately. We're going to get more right-wing nuts.
Gosh, it's hard to argue with you when you keep talking about your party like I think about
I've
it.
I've tried to tell I've tried to tell you for years that I'm an independent, and I certainly would be too embarrassed today as a former moderate Republican to be a Republican, because it's been the party has been captured by wingnuts. And your party has been, too.
Absolutely.
Her name's Pelosi. We could somehow, you know, global warming, if it gets bad enough, San Francisco is going to be underwater, and that's a damn good idea. The Republicans are doing to themselves in the Senate what they did in 2010. They should be in control now. Of course, it takes 60 votes, but they should have about 52 now. But thanks to California and Nevada and Colorado and Delaware that nominated those empty heads, if you remember, and the Democrats won. Well, we're doing it again. Indiana is the prime example. And now you talk about education. Now, listen to this closely. Dick Lugar's opponent says Social Security is unconstitutional. The age group 65 and older overwhelmingly voted for him. And you tell me the problem isn't education? Obama will not win, he will fail to lose. I've never watched...
You should have been in politics.
I never watched a primary that was more embarrassing than the Republican primary in the last several months. And they pushed Mitt so far to the right. You know, he was for global warming before he was opposed to it. The difference between Romneycare and Obamacare is, well, basically there isn't any difference. And on and on. Plus, he was forced far to the right on immigration issues, and he opposed the DREAM Act. I never thought there was anything I would agree with Rick Perry on. But he's right. You educate them and you're better off. You need 40% of the Republican, a Republican needs 40% of the Hispanic vote to win. And there's no way, in my opinion, Obama's going to get, or rather Romney's going to get 40% of the Hispanic vote. Unless he flips back and supports the DREAM Act, and then they'll accuse him of flip-flopping once again. So he's backed himself in a real corner. So this election isn't going to change very much.
Go back here, and then we'll come over here.
Good morning. You talked about cutting taxes, raising taxes and cutting spending. I'm just wondering, with all the Republicans and the Tea Party who have signed the Norquist no tax increase, how we're going to make that happen. Thank you.
There is now a crack in Mr. Norquist's head. There are Republicans starting to refuse to sign it. Jeb Bush made a very interesting comment a few weeks ago, and he said there would be no room in today's Republican Party for my father or for Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan increased taxes 11 times, never sent the Congress a balanced budget, doubled the payroll tax with Tip O'Neill and saved Social Security. But did perpetuate the biggest myth of all times in economics is that supply side crap that came from a Berkeley professor. The argument is you can't raise taxes when you're in a recession. Well, Bill Clinton did, and we had 4 years of a surplus. You can raise taxes in a depression if you do a recession if you do it accurately. You want to get this economy to grow? It doesn't depend on the level of taxes or the level of spending. It depends on the debt. And to get the economy to grow, you've got to get the government out of capital markets. And they're in there big time today at obscenely low interest rates. That's the problem. So there's never been a clearer time in my lifetime when the answer is very simple. Get the budget balanced. I don't give a damn how you do it. Get it done.
Get her done.
And and people are starting to see that. The Oklahoma senator, the doctor.
Tom Coburn.
Yeah. No. What?
Tom.
He's in Tennessee, isn't he?
No, Tom Coburn is Oklahoma.
Coburn, yeah, the doctor.
He's the one you're talking about.
Yeah, how one state could send a genius and an idiot to the Senate is beyond my point of view, but Dr. Coburn has got the guts to stand up to the Tea Party. And he didn't sign the pledge. And he lays out that we've got to get the government out of the capital markets. So there are people on both sides of the aisle that understand this.
We've got some young people in this audience, and I'll tell you the same thing I tell my classes. And when I speak to folks when they come to Washington, I still do quite a bit of that, particularly on young people in college grads. And I said two pieces of advice that I want to give you. One, I was elected in 78 and then had 5 terms running without an opponent. If you're going to run for election and you have a choice of running opposed or unopposed, take unopposed. That's my political advice to you. Now, another piece of advice to anyone that runs for office, particularly Congress of the United States, do not sign any pledges to any group of what you are going to do. You are elected to represent the people with your best judgment. You are not elected to carry someone else's agenda unless you agree with it. And as badly as Barry has beat up on the Tea Party, I feel the need to come to their defense a little bit, because I'm not sure that the majority of the American people aren't agreeing with more of what they're saying than what I would like to hope. And with Grover Norquist on the taxes, remember, we're spending today at 25% of our gross domestic product. That is historic high and cannot be sustained. But if we don't change the cost structure of our entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, we'll be spending at 30%. Within 10 years, unsustainable. We won't get there. The market won't let us. Revenue today is at 15%. Ironically, when I ran for Congress in 1978, my Republican opponent was a supply-sider and basically was calling for cutting taxes. My attitude was, I'm for cutting taxes, but you got to pay for the government that you say you want. And I suggested, since we were spending at that rate at a little over about 21.5% and we were taxing at 18%, I suggested raising taxes 1.5%, cutting spending, and balancing the budget at 20% of GDP. Those numbers will work today. That was the Simpson-Bowles approach. Those numbers will work today. But we've got to build a majority for that, which will take to get us there.
Another big myth is that we're so overtaxed. As a percent of income, if you look at all taxes, property, sales, etc., you have to go back to 1945 to find a higher tax rate percent of income than we have now.
The problem we worked into is over half of our population pays no income tax. And that's a problem of the distribution question. It's not just accumulation at the top. It's what's happening at the bottom, and our tax structure is not addressing that. Yes, they pay Social Security and property taxes. If they don't own property, if you're a renter, you pay property taxes. So there's a whole lot of basic simplistic, but you can't get basic economics that Barry has taught that I have followed and learned so much from over the years. There's certain basics, and the politics of it kind of muddies the water from time to time.
Do we have another question?
My name is Michael Libby from Iowa. One of the things we haven't talked about, although we got close when we were talking about redistribution, is the shrinking middle class. The opportunity to put more money into the economy comes from those people who spend it, but yet individuals in the middle class have seen their take-home pay deteriorate over the past 15 years. In addition to that, states such as mine that have surpluses continue to cut middle-class jobs because government workers are bad. And they also cut education, where typical middle-class families no longer can afford to send their children to school. Could you speak to that issue about the shrinking middle class and what we might do about that?
Yeah, I'll take a quick shot at that one. When you talk about education, I'm not of the school we need to throw more money at education until we've first taken a look at how we're spending that which we're spending. Any analysis on education with any other country or state to state shows that money per se is not the problem. It's something else, and I'm not smart enough to tell you what the something else is, but I think it needs to be looked at, and that's why I mentioned a moment ago from our ag universities, I think it's time for us to take a good hard look at the research we're doing and the research we need to do and see if we can't help our policymakers make some more intelligent decisions along those lines. Good luck, but that's it. On the shrinking middle class, you know the story of Henry Ford. He built a car that the middle class, that the people building them could afford to buy. I have a theory that I'm glad to hear some other folks starting to talk about. There's been an awful lot of talk about Wall Street. And, you know, I remember when the whole concept of derivatives and swaps and all of this complicated financial structure was put together. I was there. I couldn't understand it then, and I helped put it in. And then I was shocked to find out that Alan Greenspan didn't understand it 4 years ago. We have allowed to create something on Wall Street that is not helpful to our marketplace. There is too much money being made shifting money, i.e. Las Vegas style, than it is making investments in businesses and jobs that can be competitive in the international marketplace, my opinion. And with some of the problems that are happening now, look at our future market. You know, for years I was taught that the futures market is a place to hedge against our cost. Now with this tremendous cost of production we've got, you miss a crop and you haven't got it hedged, it'll bankrupt you. But you can't hedge it anymore because you don't trust the futures market as being able to have your money there if you made it in there. And LIBOR. If heads don't roll and people don't go to jail regarding using LIBOR, in which the biggest banks in the world were fixing the interest rates, okay, that's not the biggest problem. It was telling their folks down at the trading desk, here's what it's going to be next week, and you can make a bundle and thanking them for it afterwards. That's the kind of stuff that's creating the Tea Party, and I don't blame them in that endeavor. But we've got a challenge here as a country, and if we do, if we fix the fiscal cliff, we do something like Simpson-Bowles, we get our long-term entitlements realistically under control, you'll see the answer to the middle class coming back. If we don't, we got a problem.
Well, we have a tendency, evidently, this morning to put words in each other's mouth a little bit.
I tried my best.
The original concept of the Tea Party, which was grassroots democracy, is fine. That's what this country was founded on. But something happened to the Tea Party. And that is they've been co-opted by a few billionaires that are paying the bill and calling the shots and spending millions on this campaign and telling more damn lies that's ever been told on the face of the earth. I have a cabin in Colorado, and I've been there all summer, and I really don't want to come back to the Kansas heat, but I sure will be glad to get the hell out of there and not hear any presidential ads for a while, because Colorado's a swing state, and there's more lies being told on that TV than you can shake a stick at. And that's one of the reasons why the public gets so disillusioned. But the original concept of the Tea Party is fine. And Charlie brings up derivatives on Wall Street, et cetera. I've been on the board of directors of the Kansas City Board of Trade for about 15 years. And it's just amazing to watch that from the inside. Derivatives exchanged on an exchange were not part of the problem. Yet Dodd-Frank punishes derivatives passed on or traded on exchanges and lets the old bucket shops of the 30s to continue to operate. In fact, I'll argue Dodd-Frank has made it worse.
And I won't argue.
Pardon?
I won't argue with you.
Yeah. And so that's an issue where you can't expect the general public to really grasp it. It's very technical. And I'd be lying to you if I serve on the board of directors. I listen to the traders on technical stuff, because I don't know all that technical stuff. But that has to operate on a trust factor, and trust is bought. And till we get that trust back, the middle class is going to continue to suffer, because the middle class, remember, in the last 20 years has invested quite a bit in the stock market, and now they're very disillusioned. And rightly so, simply because of the trust factor.
I'm sure all of you know someone that's a senior citizen that saved their money, put it up, and intended to live off of the savings of the income off of their savings. And they're hurting now. They did all the right things, but because of the circumstances today, it is a different world.
I can't help but tell this story. The best story is when you tell them on yourself. My father passed away, and my 75-year-old mother moved to Manhattan. And she had quite a bit of money in CDs. And we would gradually move them from Redline, Pennsylvania, to Manhattan, Kansas. And one night she said to me on the phone, "Your father had only a high school education. And when he was investing my money, we were getting 10%. You got a PhD from a place called Purdue in economics, and we're getting 3. What the hell is wrong?" That's a true story, and my mom could cuss, and she wasn't very happy about it. Now, how do you explain that to her?
Well, you want me to try?
Yeah. No, I don't. Your lovely wife can try, but you just shut up. I don't want to. But that makes a very strong point. You know, I can make a loud and clear argument that we've driven these interest rates too low. We've ignored that side of the economy that depends on it for spending money. And we've decreased consumption because of it. I think we have it out of balance.
And that $16 trillion that we're paying probably 2% on average today, if it goes back to the interest rates that were here in this country when I was elected to the Congress, 18 and 20%, tell me what happens to our fiscal matters in this country at that time. And it can do it, and can do it quicker than anybody is thinking right now. That's why I don't see any other hands up, but stick a hand up. There we go. That always works.
Well, we'll have one final question, and as you answer that final question, if you have any closing comments you'd like to make, I ask you to do that also.
Burt Rutherford, Beef Magazine. Will the RFS mandate be repealed?
Don't think it'll be repealed temporarily. I don't think it matters anymore, folks. And I remember a meeting I had with the National Corn Growers Board 8 years ago now, in which we were talking about this, and I said, you know, y'all need to understand, I think, that the day will come when you will have to make a decision to sell your corn to your refinery at a price that's less what you can get in the food and feed market, or shut your refinery down. Today, there is a market for ethanol. It does not need government help whatsoever, and the subsidies are gone. The mandate is still there. But the price of corn is now set by the price of oil. And there is going to be a market for a certain amount of ethanol, and that market should be tested. So I personally believe that it ought to be waived for this year. And then seriously, our energy policy, which we do not have in this country, and that's way too complicated to get into in the last 2 minutes here. But the RFS standard, having the federal government keep their foot on the scale on behalf of ethanol at a time when the drought is doing what it's already doing to the supply, is not government at its best action and needs to be waived for this year and then a serious discussion made on it.
I'm willing to agree with you, Charlie, on a year's waiver. But what worries me about a year's waiver is that a year's waiver becomes permanent. And I still think this country's long-term problem is lack of energy independence. And the role of government is to alter the marketplace. If the market was perfect, we wouldn't have policy. But the market doesn't do everything we prefer as a society. So we have policy. And a lot of the world's problems can be solved when we're no longer dependent on the Middle East and Venezuela, etc. So we desperately need an energy policy, and I would argue it could include all forms of energy. Demand will rise fast enough that there's a piece of the pie for everybody, and I don't know why we like to fight so damn much. Especially between agriculture and oil and gas within agriculture. You know, you go to an NCBA meeting and they cuss ethanol, and there sits the primary corn growers of the United States belonging to both organizations. So we need to reach some kind of a happy medium.
That's why I put it in the context of an energy policy. We do not have an energy policy for our country. We can be energy self-sufficient in North America within 2 to 5 years. energy independent in North America, not in the United States, but in North America, Canada, United States, and Mexico. That's in our best short-term, intermediate, and long-term future. The supplemental energy, if they cannot be sustainable in the marketplace, will not be sustainable to the investors that invest in them. And that is a real challenge of how you do it. We need to continue the research. Remember, cellulosic was going to save it. Well, it hadn't happened. We haven't got the technology to do it. Corn can be converted to ethanol today without any government mandate and sell in the marketplace competitive with $80 and $90 oil. And if it's $150 oil, it is very profitable. The value of corn is set by the price of oil. And the sooner both industries start looking at that, the better off we all are going to be. And that's why I said in the context of a energy program for America.
Final comments? I meant what I said at the beginning, that I am optimistic over the long haul. Primarily because of those young students that I'll, you know, in a few weeks I will leave Colorado where it'll be 70 degrees and the humidity will be 10, and I'll hit Gooden and it'll be 110 degrees and the humidity will be 80, and I look in the mirror and say, you damn fool, what the hell are you doing this for? But then Monday morning I'll see all 110 of those students, and I've been at this for 41 years, and it makes it all worth it. But they know there's not an automatic job waiting at the other end. They know they got to be more serious-minded. They know what kind of a mess they're going to inherit. I've actually got one of them I'm going to have in class this fall who's now a campaign manager for one of the state Senate offices. So these kids are going to be involved. They're smart. The future is really bright. Charlie knows I don't patronize, but I often long for the days of Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan. Tip had a birthday, or rather Ronald Reagan had a birthday party for Tip in the White House. You might have been there. Tip was 75 years old. Reagan got up. They really liked each other. Reagan got up and said, Mr. Speaker, if I had a ticket to heaven and you didn't have one too, I'd give mine away and go to hell with you. Now, somehow I can't see Boehner and Obama doing that. And I long for the days of congressmen like my good friend Steno. I noticed I've taught him something because he didn't argue with me on target prices today. But you never needed to worry about where Charlie was coming from. He told you right up front. He listened. He heard you out. His word was good. And he basically went down the middle where most of us go. So what we really need to do if you want to solve all these problems is fire that entire damn Congress and put those blue dogs back in office. It's a pleasure, Charlie, to be on this panel with you.
Well, feelings mutual, and let me just kind of sum up. There were so many things we could have talked about, so important to agriculture and to our country. Because when you say important to agriculture, that's our country. Everyone eats. Immigration policy. Endangered species. Clean Water Act. Clean Air Act. We talked about a little about RFS, obesity. Barry did a beautiful job of talking about that problem as it is, not as we wished it were. And it just popped into my mind a little success story that I repeat quite often. You know, Bill Clinton, President Clinton, and the Congress, we balanced the budget right before 2000. And it was hard getting there. And it was doing the same way, cutting spending and raising taxes, welfare reform, doing a lot of things. But the credit to that does not go to Bill Clinton by himself. The credit to me goes from, first off, to President Bush 41. He laid the foundation for the economy that we enjoyed through the 1990s. And he paid in the election because he raised taxes. But he laid the foundation and the actions that were taken there, but he got no credit. The walls on our balanced budget of the 1990s occurred because of my friends on the other side of the aisle. Taking over the House in 1994, after we Democrats had controlled it for 40 years, and that was good for the country. It caused a change in the manner in which we govern, and we could not and would not have gotten to where we needed to get without Republicans controlling the House during that period of time. And then President Clinton put the roof on it. In each of those endeavors, no one would have accomplished anything were it not willingness to compromise. Barry does a beautiful job of talking about the Tip O'Neill, Ronald Reagan. I was there, I know. And it was tough going. But both of them had that quality of leadership to where when they spoke, their party did not argue with them like we have today. That's what we're looking for. And I make one suggestion to every Congress, and nobody has listened. But if this Congress, first off in the Senate, if they would agree in the next 13 working days between now and November the 6th, that no matter who is elected, they would be a little more judicial with the use of the 60-vote rule, go back to the old ways of doing filibusters to where you actually have to keep the floor and filibuster, and make sure when you filibuster that which is important for the future of the country. And for the House and the Senate, novel idea. When you're elected this November, agree that there will be no fundraising of any type for the first 6 months of next year under the novel thought that you're going to spend your time working on that which you were elected to do and not worrying about the next election. And then agree that you're going to come to Washington and you're going to work at least 5 days a week and maybe Saturdays, Sundays. And not just 8 hours a day, but whatever hours required to get the job done and get a budget passed on time. Make these decisions you're going to have to make next year. And do it in the process in which our forefathers intended that we do it. Debate, discussions, and voting and the majority rule. What would be wrong with that? Actually spending time in Washington. I get so tired and frustrated hearing members of Congress talk about their job being back home. Since when? Getting elected to the Board of Directors of United States, Inc. is your job back home and not in Washington doing that which you were elected to do. But yet today, families stay home, members cannot wait to get back home, and if that doesn't change, January, February, March of next year, we're not going to make the decisions, have the decision made that we need to make. But I think it is. So I'll close on an optimistic note, too. It's been enjoyable being with you. Always glad, just tremendously pleasurable for me to be on the podium with this guy to my right. Even though philosophically, we're pretty much in the radical center. Thank you.